Andrew Swiler, welcome to the show, buddy.
Thanks, Matt. It's an honor to be here.
Did you see yourself as an entrepreneur?
My whole lineage is of entrepreneurs. So I always knew that was sort of inside of me. I started my career in private equity after I got out of college. Got super burned out and told my boss one day I was going to go to Europe and just travel. Ended up traveling for about 6 months. Met my wife while I was in Croatia. Ended up convincing her to move with me to San Francisco. After a couple years there, my wife said to me she hated San Francisco. And so we packed our things, moved back to Barcelona. I didn't speak the language, didn't know what to do. And her and I ended up starting an eyewear company. I was supposed to be there for about a year. Ended up sticking around for about 6 years. After that, I didn't really know what I was going to do. I knew that I was going to continue to live in Spain, and so I needed a remote company. So software or e-commerce were really the only options then. Moving to Spain, moving to Barcelona basically forced me to do it. I had no other option. I had to start a company. That sort of instinct from seeing my dad do it all those years, my grandfather, kind of kicked in once I moved over here.
Guys, Matt Haycox here, and welcome to another episode of the Matt Haycox Show, where today I am joined by entrepreneur, investor, CEO, Andrew Swiler. He is an expert in financing, in HR, in team building, in tech, and all things business strategy, money, and everything in between. So I am very much looking forward to having a chat here. We're going to dig deep on financing and acquisition, which is something Andrew's done recently. We're going to talk about remote team building, which obviously everyone knows my pet hate is work from home, probably a little bit more than pet hate. So I'd love to hear your theories and tips on remote team building and everything else, Andrew. So welcome to the show, buddy.
Thanks, Matt. It's an honor to be here. I know you've had some great guests, so I was really excited to meet you and get a chance to learn from you too.
Good. Well, I always love these chats. I always say, even if no one ever listened or watched, you know, it's just for me, it's always a great chance to chat with a really interesting person and almost have a private conversation, private mastermind where you know, even if nobody else gets to learn, I always get to further my business education. So
me too.
Everybody should have a podcast. Well, listen, just obviously, I'm giving you an intro, but just give yourself, I guess, maybe pad out my intro. And just let's give a bit of context to who you are, why you're here, and tell me which direction you want to take the chat in.
Yeah, so I started my career actually in private equity after I got out of college. Got completely burned out from that. We were doing private equity like turnarounds, working with companies that were coming out of bankruptcy, acquiring them, turning them around, trying to take them public or sell them off to a new buyer. 100-hour work weeks, never at home, always at the office. Got super burned out and told my boss one day I was going to go to Europe and just travel and write. And he was like, "Wow, you got to go. You've clearly run aground here." So ended up traveling for about 6 months. Met my wife while I was in Croatia. And ended up convincing her to move with me to San Francisco. I knew I didn't want to go back into private equity. I wanted to go into tech. I wanted to go into building something rather than taking it apart, basically. And started out working as a CFO for software companies in San Francisco. And after a couple of years there, my wife said to me she hated San Francisco. She wanted to move back to Barcelona where she was from. And so we packed our things, moved back to Barcelona. I didn't speak the language, didn't know what to do. And her and I ended up starting an eyewear company. And we ran that for about 6 years. I was supposed to be there for about a year, helping her kind of get it started. And then I was going to go do something else. Ended up sticking around for about 6 years. We grew it franchises in different parts of the world, in the Middle East, Latin America, around Europe. And we ended up selling that in 2019, right before the pandemic. And after that, I didn't really know what I was going to do. I knew about sort of the world of search funds, which are people that raise money to go buy small businesses. I knew I didn't want to really do that. I knew I didn't want to buy a manufacturing company. I had background, working with software companies. I had lots of different backgrounds in retail. And I knew that I was going to continue to live in Spain. And so I needed a remote company. So software or e-commerce were really the only options there. And e-commerce, I just come from, I guess, one of those things, the shiny object syndrome. I was tired of working in e-commerce. I said, I'm going to go back into software, work in this. And ended up spending about 18 months looking for a company to acquire. We found Lanteria and we acquired it back in June of 2022 from the previous owners were from Ukraine. It's a US-based company. We're mainly focused on US clients, but we've got clients pretty much all over the world. And we do about 2.5 million in revenue right now. And we're looking to grow it to about 10 million over the next 3 to 4 years.
Well, look, we'll go into some specific things on the company, and also, I guess talk about the financing of that acquisition. A little rewind question for me. I mean, when you were working in private equity, did you see yourself as an entrepreneur back then? And I guess I asked the question in the context of, I'm sure many entrepreneurs and business owners, when taking money from private equity would probably argue that, private equity guys are probably not business operators, not business owners, just financial magicians or destroyers, and many relationships break down pretty rapidly in that space. I mean, I guess coming from the other side of it, did you feel at home in private equity, or did you think maybe this isn't for me? I'd rather be an operator.
So I grew up, my whole lineage is of entrepreneurs. So both of my grandfathers were entrepreneurs. My great grandfather was an entrepreneur. My dad was an entrepreneur. So I always knew I had this inside of me. I'm not a good employee. I still am not a good employee. I've worked for some people a little bit, but I'm an awful employee because I don't own something. I really don't care about it. And I don't put in the same effort or the same brain power that I put into things that I own. So I always knew that was sort of inside of me. I think when I was in private equity, it was interesting because we did get to operate businesses. I mean, we were inside of businesses, we were operating them. We were day to day, because we were turning things around. So we were buying it. We had to kind of step in, take it apart, figure out what to do with, the team, what to do with positioning. So there were certain parts of operations there that were interesting, but I never viewed myself as a PE guy. And I never was wanted to get on a partner track or do that. It was okay, this is a great learning experience. Even when I was in college, my dad said, get a finance degree and then you can actually make money and you don't have to be a marketing guy that's struggling. He's like, you can always figure out marketing. Just go get a finance degree and then you always have a backstop if things go wrong. So I never viewed myself that way. I always wanted to operate, and moving to Spain, moving to Barcelona basically forced me to do it. I had no other option. I didn't speak the language, so nobody was going to hire me and I had to start a company. So I just that sort of instinct from seeing my dad do it all those years and my grandfather kind of kicked in once I moved over here. It was all right, what can we sell? What can we put together? How can we raise money? How can we put this together? And that was sort of the first 6 to 12 months that I lived here, was just putting it all in motion.
Well, let's talk about the acquisition then. I mean, I don't know how let's say open you can be about real numbers and things, but talk to me about the process of raising the funds and how you structure the deal once you'd identified that target.
So the target came to us earlier. I would say these guys were looking to sell, but they became, because of the Ukraine situation, the war in Ukraine, they became, I wouldn't say for sellers, but they definitely had some issues where clients were asking questions, employees. I mean, they had employees in the US, they had employees in Europe, and the employees were asking questions like, what's going to happen to the company? What's the continuity plan here? Clients were asking the same thing. So it got to the point where they kind of had to sell the company at some point, or they would have to get out of the country at some point, but they didn't know how long it was going to take them. So we had been talking to them a little bit leading up to the war. When I found out about this deal, I started calling. We knew the deal I was looking for, I wanted to be able to put an SBA loan. So in the US, obviously there's the SBA, which allows you to, it's a government-backed lending program where you can get up to $5 million from banks, but the government guarantees 85% of it right now, I think.
So I forget what we... I forget what the name is for the we have something we certainly used to have something semi-similar to and some enterprise loan or other, but it's a pretty unique US thing that then, is it? It's a government backed loan to promote interest in particular areas of business, whether that's geographic or sectorial or something, is it?
Yeah, I would say it's unique. I haven't seen it in many other countries. I know in Japan there's something a little bit similar, but it's focused on basically acquisitions. So to acquire companies, it's focused on working capital a little bit, and then it's focused on real estate. So if you're a company and you want to go buy a piece of real estate, you can actually almost get what's essentially a low interest rate mortgage to go buy properties with your company. And they do 30-year fixed term loans, which is absolutely incredible. So if you are buying property, it's an amazing thing, but it's also one of the few ways to acquire businesses but they focus specifically on, it has to be sort of showing that this is like an owner operator. Like you can't just be a PE firm that comes around and says like, hey, we need $5 million extra, throw in, you know, throw into the bank. It has to be shown that like, this is sort of a small business. There's a reason for buying it. And there's no other lender that would back this basically.
And so just so I'm clear, were you looking to use that loan to acquire the business, or you were looking to acquire a business that you could then go and get one of those loans into to grow it?
No, it was to acquire it. I mean, the easiest way to get one of these loans is through acquisitions or through acquiring property, basically. So we knew going into it, we were going to do, you know, sort of this typical sort of independent sponsor model where people take an SBA loan, they put part of his SBA, usually the SBA will, they'll lend up to 90% loan to value. But for a software company, they wanted about 50%. So that we knew we needed to cover about 50% with our own, my own funds and going out to find other investors. So before going out to the SBA, obviously I'm based in Spain. The founders were based in Ukraine. The company was a US-based company. So the SBA had a lot, the bank that we ended up lending with had a lot of issues with it. And I talked to 50 banks before them and nobody would lend to me. Nobody wanted to touch the deal. But beforehand, I went out basically just dialing for dollars. So I live in front of a park here in Barcelona and I would go out every night. I would cold email investors, anyone that would answer the email. I would get on the phone with them, kind of pitch the deal, explain it to them. I probably did 100 of these phone calls. The people that invested, we ended up getting 5 investors that put in about $1 million to acquire the company. The 5 guys we talked to them for maybe 20 minutes each. Like I barely had to convince them. They looked at the raw numbers. They looked at the business. They looked at the market that it was in. They said, okay, there's not a lot of downside here. Like you would really have to screw things up for this business to fall apart. And so they were willing to jump on without doing too much due diligence into the business. Obviously, you know, once they agreed to it, we had to send over some of the legal documents, kind of work through some of the different terms, but it was a relatively easy transaction to close with the private investors and the SBA loan. Once we found this one bank that was willing to loan to me, really the biggest hiccup that I had was you needed a life insurance policy, which is also apparently really hard to do from as a foreigner. So the U.S. life insurance companies will not lend to anyone outside of the U.S. or they won't insure anyone outside the U.S. So I had to find an international life insurance policy and get that done and then get the bank to accept that international life insurance policy. So the whole transaction, I would say it took 3 months, 4 months in total from like getting an LOI in place to sort of putting all the financing in place and closing the deal. So it was relatively painless for where I was. I mean, I thought it was almost impossible. Like it was a Hail Mary to say like a guy living in Spain, buying this company from these Ukrainian guys would actually be able to fund this. But we ended up doing it. We got lucky. Usually a software deal is maybe 3 to 10x revenue is a typical sort of software multiple. We got lucky that these guys what I told them is we would pay them 1x trailing 12 months sales, whatever that landed at. And they had to leave 150K in working capital in the business and we wouldn't pay any deferred revenue. So they were doing, you know, annual contracts and we said, we'll pay for whatever, you know, whatever exists as revenue, but we're not going to pay for, you know, pre-collected revenue. That's going to stay with us. So we got a really good deal. So it, like I said, the investors that we had kind of saw this as a no-brainer, like the deal that you've worked out really is favorable for us and you'd have to really screw up to miss this one.
And tell me, with the investors, because you said you were doing a lot of cold emails out, cold outreach to these investors. Where, I mean, how were you selecting that data? I mean, you know, how cold were these? I mean, you must have had some vague strategy of who to identify for the, you know, to be a potential investor.
It was pretty cool. I mean, I had a guy in Pakistan scraping. There's a website called searchfunder.com. I had a guy in Pakistan scraping the website for data of people's emails and then going on LinkedIn and verifying their emails. And then we used Apollo, which is, you know, an outbound email tool. So they were cool. I mean, I knew the people on SearchFunder are investing in these types of deals. And then I was going on AngelList as well and finding angel investors. Yeah. One of our main investors is a syndicate that's based off of AngelList. So they put in about 300K. They're called Tiny Seed. So it wasn't cold in the sense of I have no idea who I'm going to contact, but it was cold in the sense that none of these people that invest in our company knew who I was. Now I've become friends with some of them. Like some of them have traveled to Barcelona and I've met them when I've been back in the US. So we become friendly. But at the time, it was a guy, I wasn't even on video calls. Like I was calling them on the phone, basically. So it was interesting. I mean, luckily it worked out, but it could have easily not worked out.
So the business itself, it's in the HR software space.
Yes, we compete with, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with Workday, SAP SuccessFactors.
I mean, I know the names, but I'm not sure what, you know, exactly what they do, but I do know the names, yeah.
Bamboo HR. So, I mean, if you work in a bigger company, like I'm an entrepreneur, so I've besides in our private equity company, I never really worked with an HR management system. So I didn't really know what it was either. I just knew this was an interesting market. So I mean, Workday's, you know, billions and billions of dollars of revenue a year. They're a huge, massive company. They essentially, what it does is if you're onboarding employees, you got your sort of a suite of software that onboards the employees, you know, takes care of all their payroll, takes care of all their pay slips, takes care of all their contracts. Like if an employee needs to know, like, what's my contract look like? What is my boss's feedback about me? What are my vacation days? When have I been on vacation? What are my sick days? You know, anything that relates to their sort of work contract sits inside of products like Lenteria or Workday. So that's essentially what it is. People basically say it's hire to retire software. So anything inside the employee lifecycle and sort of keeping track of performance management, keeping track of, you know, learning management, all sort of sits inside of our suite of software.
And does this work in multi-jurisdictions? Or, you know, I mean, or yeah. I mean, do you have to tailor it, you know, between countries or, you know, individual rules and things?
We do, depending on the client. There are clients that, you know, need, they have special needs of how vacation days are set up, for example. That's a pretty typical one. So we had a client, a large shipping container company that has been acquiring shipping companies around the world. And every time they acquire a new company, they say, you know, we need a Danish vacation absence management plan. So we have to kind of hard code that into our system and set it up for that. But we actually have a really good system for multinationals and for like conglomerates. So it was set up to not necessarily be for one country and one jurisdiction, because I mean, we're predominantly in North America, but we sell pretty much all of the, I think we're in 40 countries that we sell in. So we can pretty much tailor it with a reasonable amount of time. I mean, it might take us 15 hours of development to tailor it to a specific jurisdiction. And there are countries that really don't feel like India, for example, is not a great fit for us. They have a lot of really specific needs for their employment and teams, but we have clients all over the world. So.
And what's your sales and marketing strategy? Is it inbound leads from people finding this software online?
So it's changed quite a bit. So when we took over, I mean, the biggest issue with this company was sales and marketing. So they had been flat in sales for about 5 years. Essentially, they'd been stable. The previous owners really weren't motivated to grow. They were pretty comfortable with the size of their company. The sales and marketing team had been with the company for about 8 years, which in software is like an eternity. Usually sales and marketing has, you know, a three-year max lifecycle that goes into it. So we tried to keep the team together. Like we tried to say, okay, maybe we can shake the rust off ourselves and get this moving. But eventually most of the sales and marketing team we've gotten rid of. We've kept one guy that's an account executive that's been with the company for about 10 years. The previous group, what they were basically doing was inbound market, like standard, you know, leads come in, marketing throws them over the fence to the sales team runs the demos and tries to close the deal. What we've seen though, is the market changed a ton since COVID, like millions, hundreds of millions pumped into a lot of these competitors. And it's way more competitive. Just today we were looking at, one of our competitors is spending $300,000 a month on PPC just in the US alone. So they're pumping a ton of money into PPC ads. So ours just don't show up. So we've tried to get more creative. We try and do a mix of inbound and outbound. We've got an SDR that, you know, is researching. We're using like G2 intent data that's coming in saying like, who's visiting, who's looking currently in the market. We're using another tool called Lead Feeder. So we can see who's looking at our website and sending that over to our SDR. SDR does research, try and find the profile that maybe is looking at us, and then send direct outreach email to them. What we found is a lot of people in HR are just overwhelmed right now with there's so many tools, so much stuff that's out in the market. So what we're doing is inviting them on our podcast. So we will find people and that are targets. Instead of sending them like, hey, come and book a demo with us, we'll look on their LinkedIn, see something that they wrote about maybe, or something that they've commented on, and say, this was really interesting. We'd like to dig deeper with you and do like a 15 to 20 minute interview. And what we've seen is people are open to that because it kind of plays into their own, unless they're very shy, it plays into their own vanity. And they're like, oh, great, cool. You want to have me on your podcast? So we talk to them on our podcast. They learn about us. They share our podcast with other people in their HR community. And we've seen that's actually, it's really long tail. Like it takes a long time for that to develop, but we have seen that it's starting to generate some leads for us. And at least it gets people to talk to us.
And do you think you've learned about HR insofar as HR from a business owner's perspective, by being involved in this business? Because I mean, I know we're going to move on to talk about things like building remote teams and I guess HR departments. But is that something you've learned more about because you had this business and it's been like an accidental side effect, or have you learned that kind of stuff from running the businesses anyway?
Yeah, I've learned it from just being in this business. So like I always say, like, to people that are entrepreneurs that want to be entrepreneurs, I always tell them, like, if you're just looking at the numbers and the money and everything, that's great. But a lot of that can be long term. I mean, you might be 10 years until you're really seeing an exit or seeing fruit from the labor that you're putting in. And one of the key things for me being an entrepreneur is you're lucky that you get to just work on things that interest you. So, but what might be interesting to you should be like the day-to-day work. So for me, just getting to know HR, like, what is HR? I have no idea. It sounds super boring. It sounds like something I had no interest in before. But if you just get into like the minutiae of it and you start talking to these people on like our podcast, I always just say to entrepreneurs, like, the key to being an entrepreneur is just being interested. Just stay interested in whatever's in front of you that day. It might be super boring. It might be just doing bookkeeping or reviewing, tax code. But if you don't find interest in these like little things, it's going to be hard to, keep pushing that boulder up the hill for 5 to 10 years until you really hit pay dirt. So what I found just in HR is just getting these people on like our podcast and talking to them. I just learned about how, people run manufacturing companies, how people hire people in manufacturing companies, how people hire people overseas, how people hire or, work on performance management to keep their employees engaged on a day-to-day basis in businesses that are not, you're not working at a sexy tech startup. You're like working in a very boring, like, local furniture manufacturer. And it's like, how do you keep your employees engaged? Because it's important. Like, in today's market, people, people talk about AI and what's in the future, but like, people are running these businesses and they're the key engine and motor of any business's growth. So we learn about that through the HR people.
And what do you think two or three top tactics for continued employee engagement are? I mean, does it change wildly from business type to business type, or are there some pretty universal things?
I mean, the universal thing that we always hear from people is to talk to your people, which seems pretty obvious. And it's really hard to do because it, depending on like the scale of your business or how many managers are, on top, you might have a manager who runs an entire plant and can only talk to so many people in one day. But the key thing that always comes up in any of these conversations is get in front of your people, talk to them, listen to them, show them that you're listening, take their feedback and try and make actionable things out of their feedback. Not just like, yeah, thanks, that sounds great. And then that information just disappears into the ether. When the employees see like what they said actually turned into something, even if just a small thing, like the, we want a different soda machine. If people see they made an impact, that, it goes a long way. Like, that's one of the number one performance things I've seen. The other thing is regular communication, like a set cadence between managers and the people that work for them that gets set up, whether it's weekly or biweekly. It seems simple, but that's also a thing that, 30 minutes with the employee, they might just be able to complain to you for 30 minutes about, Sheila next door that she doesn't like. And that's it. As long as they had a sounding board, that keeps them engaged, keeps them in the business, keeps them kind of interested in what's going on, and makes them feel comfortable sort of where they're working. Those are the two main things we see. And then, you know, from there, obviously compensation, you know, making sure you're understanding the market, making sure that you're keeping track of like what's going on with similar types of profiles. So you're compensating your people in the correct way. If you want highly engaged, I mean, every organization is different. I mean, some organizations, they work where it's, I'm going to pay bottom dollar and I'm going to churn people out, but I have a really good system of onboarding, offboarding people. And that's my system. And that's how my company works, which is great. But it, you know, depends on what you're trying to do. I personally think that onboarding employees and the payment that goes into employees is so high that if you're not trying to keep them for at least 3 years, you're just wasting your money, because it's going to cost you a lot of money to acquire them. It's going to cost you a lot of money to hire them. It's going to cost you a lot of money to onboard them. And then they're going to be disengaged for several months before leaving. So these are huge costs that go into, you know, hiring and firing people.
And how big's your team and your business, and how spread is that then geographically?
Ours is pretty small. So we have 17 full-time employees right now. We'll probably be 20 next month. So we have a few people who are hiring right now. We have then like some extraneous like freelancers that work for us on SEO and PPC and things like that. And they're all over the place. I mean, we still have part of the team from Ukraine that when we took over, we've diversified that a little bit. When we took over, most of the team was in Ukraine, and we've had to either let people go or sort of move them into part-time roles because we, you know, it was too much risk having that many people in Ukraine. But right now we have a handful of people in Ukraine, India, here in Western Europe. We have three people in the US, two people in Canada. And I think that's it right now. We have some partners that are in Australia as well that work with us, but they're not employees with us. But it's a decent sized team, and it's fully remote.
And do you believe that remote team then is as productive as it were? And I know it's a completely hypothetical question because you've got different people all over the world, but I mean, if you could have the team you've got now, or you picked a destination somewhere and built an office-based team, you know, do you believe that you've got a more productive, more diverse setup from the remote working?
So for me, remote work, I'm not a remote work maximalist. Like, you're not going to get from me like the remote work is the only future and everything else is BS. I think that if you want to build a remote company, you have to do it consciously to say, hey, we need to hire people that are used to working remote, that feel a lot of ownership in the work that they do. Like for me, the only people that work for a remote team are like high agency. You don't need to micromanage them. You don't need to be on top of them. They are in it because they want sort of their own personal values of, I want to be with my family. I want to have free time. I want to live where I want to live.
How do you find and suss out those people? Because, I mean, I guess, you know, there's the people who want to be with the family, who are going to, you know, work like dogs for the 8 or 9 or 10 hours a day that they're working, but they genuinely want to be with the family. And then there's the people who say they want to be with the family because really they want to, you know, they know that in today's climate they can demand to work from home, and, you know, employers don't have much choice other than to say yes. And then they sit at home in the pajamas watching YouTube all day.
Yeah, it's
how do you distinguish?
It's very hard. I only work with people that we see output from. I mean, we put people on pretty strict like probation when they come on, that we want to see, you know, performance. We want to see that, you know, people are checking in daily. We do daily, like most of our teams do daily stand-ups where they get together in the morning, talk about, you know, issues, what they worked on, what they're going to work on, what issues they might have that other team members do. So, I mean, like sales and marketing does that. Our product team does it. Our QA team does it. Everyone does get together pretty much daily. And we try and do interdisciplinary, you know, maybe like our delivery team and our product team get together at least like Tuesdays and Thursdays, for example, to discuss things. And then we do maybe a weekly all hands meeting. So we do try to keep communication open and make it so people are talking. We use Slack a lot. So you'll see, you know, people are more active and people are less active. I mean, our developers obviously are not as active, but developers are very easy in the sense that you put tasks up on Jira, they grab the tasks, they work on them. You know, our CTO kind of knows like what's everyone's bandwidth. He sees, you know, when people are sort of slacking off or falling behind, and kind of say to them like, hey, this week, what happened? Like, why, you know, you took this many tasks, this task could have been done a lot faster. So you can track that. obviously sales and marketing as well. I mean, I tend not to be like, hey, how many calls did you make? How many emails did you send? It's more about output than, you know, what the input was. But if you see people aren't having output and you're having weekly calls or daily standups, you ask like, why isn't this output happening? What's going on? Like, what are you seeing? And if it's, you know, the market's changing or people are on vacation, okay. But if you see it consistently from the same person, then it's, you know, time to change objectives. I think one of the key things too is just making objectives very clear and making them very visible. So like we have them on Jira or in Asana, where people see like every week, what am I objective? Like how many leads do I need to generate every week? How many tickets do I need to take? How many hours do I need to work on this? And it's not easy, but like I said, it's really a cultural thing of like who the people are. Like I don't think there are a lot of people that go to work for social reasons. Like I know people that their friends or people that they've met at work. If that's what you want to do, or if that's important to you, remote work is not going to be your thing. Like that's not going to work because you're not going to make friends with, you know, Olga that lives in Ukraine. It's just not going to happen. It'll be interesting to be working with someone like that. But really what you're getting is you get this expansive pool of talent. Like when I go recruit people, we'll post jobs on LinkedIn in, you know, 15 different countries over a week long period. And we only talk to the people that are the top people that come in from all 15 of those countries. And what you find is that if I was just in Denver and I was looking for the top guy in Denver, you know, the pool is so much smaller and that guy's getting picked off from all sorts of companies just in Denver that want that work for me. We might be competitive because people see like, oh, an American company, I'm based in India. I get a better salary. I get to work with, you know, sort of people that are a little bit more motivated, a little bit higher, you know, further along than where I am, because maybe locally I couldn't find this type of company. And it gives people this interesting sort of incentive that you wouldn't get if you were just hiring people in that local market. Like for me, it would be hard to imagine being forced to put a job post for one city and say, well, that's it. We can't find them.
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned a couple of tools, and I was going to ask you what you would recommend as a top two or three tools, your pieces of software that really help to run a remote team. I mean, you mentioned Slack, you mentioned Asana, is it? So people probably know Slack, and what does Asana do, and what else would you recommend for being able to manage a team better?
So Jira and Asana are essentially the same. It's project management. The difference is Jira is really focused on developer sort of, like if you try and fit like a creative team into Jira, it usually doesn't work. They usually get upset with it. They don't like the UI. They don't like how it's set up. But Jira is a great tool for, you know, running remote software development teams that, you know, you can track, even you can put your time tracking tool. So we do use time tracking tools for our customers. So like we have billable hours and non-billable hours for certain things when customers are working on customizations. So we don't track we don't tell our guys that they have to click in and click, you know, check in and check out when they're working on something, unless it's for a client. So we can, you know, directly pull how many hours we're working on a certain task and then be able to send that information to our clients. Say, hey, here's the ticket. Here's what was worked on. Here's all the deliverables, here's how much time it took, and here's all like the feedback, you know, between the QA and the development team. So they can see it and see transparently, like what's going on. So Jira is great for that. Asana is a project management tool, but it's great for it's very easy to use. It's great for teamwork. They have a great mobile app. So you can set everything up. You can have your weekly standups, your daily standup. You can even have your meetings already predetermined in there of like what we're gonna talk about. And people can add their things in there. But I see it as those three tools, but Slack is really the key one for us. I mean, Slack is like our office, basically.
And obviously, you talk about not so much micromanaging the inputs, but heavily managing the outputs. I guess nowhere is that probably more visible than sales. Do you get involved in the sales a lot yourself, or I mean, do you consider yourself a sales guy? Do you train your sales team?
I don't train my sales. I never worked as a traditional like sales guy. So I don't feel I have like the bona fide information to go to a sales team and say to them like, no, this is how you should be selling, because I just don't have that background. I do have other people that I'm friendly with that come in and step in and help me out with, you know, when we're training our sales team, when they help me sort of review our numbers, look at how our sales guys are doing. And they do help me work through some of these issues. I do get involved later in the sales pitch. So as we have pretty complex sales, so this isn't like you just sign up or do a free trial. I mean, these are like we usually have to go through three or four sets of demos with different stakeholders. And then once it gets to, you know, either the CFO or the VP of HR or whatever, then I'll usually jump into the call, talk to them, maybe make an offer to like say, hey, you know, this is typically our pricing, but we can offer you this for, you know, the first year if you guys sign up in the next, whatever, 30 days. So I'll get involved in some of that stuff, but I try and leave it up to our sales team. We do use tools like Otter, which is like an AI sort of note-taking tool. We do use that to record calls with clients, but it's not to criticize our sales guys. It's more to like give them notes, or so they see, like they can see sort of patterns, like what people are asking about. And then we can sort of share it internally and see like, what are these clients asking about? What's going on? And we especially use that like the implementation phase, once it passes sales, where we get a lot of customers who, you know, they say like, but you told me this 2 weeks ago, or the sales guy told me this or whatever. And if you keep this information, it's way easier. You're like, no, our sales guy didn't say that. Like, here's what was told you, and here's what we sold you. And we get a lot of that. The customers, you know, 3 months later, they're implementing. They say, but the guy told me this, whatever, during the sales process. And if it's not recorded, you can't push back.
So what's next for the business? What's next for you? How do you see the growth going? And I mean, I assume the plan is an exit at some point.
So I'm actually working on right now raising more money to raise about 25 million. The idea is to build sort of, I guess, what you call a roll up. So acquire, you know, two or three more HR software companies, bolt them onto our current software offering. So we're really niched into like Microsoft. So we sell to Microsoft customers. We are trying to find, you know, benefit software, payroll softwares, you know, more, it could be including performance management softwares that we're to bolt onto our offering, almost like a fund, and go out to the market. So the way I see it is, you know, we do all this work to bring in clients or to try and go out to the market and find clients. And sometimes our offering is just not the right fit for them. But if we had a complementary software or something else that might be the right fit for them, or vice versa, where, you know, a smaller, lighter product that we get them into our ecosystem in some way on something that might be a little bit cheaper, it's just a point solution. And now we've got that person sort of in our ecosystem. We have their contact information. We can upsell them into maybe our more complex products. More, you know, enterprise style products later on. So that's what we're doing right now. We're out there trying to raise about 25 million and acquire two to three more companies that would come with us. So that's the big goal. And then the idea from there is to sort of build it into an exit over the next 5-6 years.
And how are you going about doing this raise? I mean, presumably you've moved on from scraping cold email lists to raise your 25 mil.
Not much. It's not much different. Just the numbers.
Bigger numbers.
Yeah, just bigger. I mean, bigger numbers, it's easier to target. You know, we're talking to some private equity firms that also, you know, they invest like into other firms as well. So there are some people that have pretty big funds and they say, okay, we also invest. They're basically like funds of funds. A lot of family offices. So ultra high net worth individuals that have set up family offices around the world. So scraping websites like LP Allocator that show you all the different LPs that are investing currently into funds, PitchBook as well, looking at who's actively doing deals, doing outreach to either, you know, the head of the family office, you know, some of the research analysts, trying to get in front of as many people as possible. I was just in the US last week, meeting with a couple of these groups. It's a longer process than the other ones. I mean, the other one, you tell someone write a $500,000, $250,000 check, and the due diligence, the time frame is a little bit shorter, but when you start saying, you know, $5 to $10 million checks, the timeline extends quite a bit. And there has to be more questions and kind of show them the reason for doing this. But we've already done, for example, we did a curated outreach to about 200 companies that were potential acquisition targets. I sent 200 emails and I got 35 companies that were interested in being acquired by us, because the market has shifted so much the last, I'd say, 18 months, where companies, they can't find their next round of funding. They don't know what to do. The VCs see that these are companies that aren't going to be unicorns. They're not going to, you know, hit these big exits, but they're good companies. They've built up a brand. they could be profitable if they didn't have these ridiculous sales structures where they hired, you know, 50 SDRs and a bunch of account executives and overspent. So there's an opportunity here where companies are, you know, motivated to sell, the board is motivated to sell, and there's not that many buyers or acquirers there in this like subscale, like, you know, companies are doing 2 to 5 million in ARR, sort of what we're looking at. We're not looking at the big, you know, $100 million companies. So there's an opportunity there. And I think there's a huge opportunity. I mean, the HR tech space is supposed to grow 12% per year over the next 8 years. So there's a huge opportunity there as well, just in the expansion of the budget for HR teams. Hiring has become a huge, hiring retention has become a huge part for most companies, especially since COVID, with all these shifts of, you know, like you said, going to remote work, you know, what are we doing? How are we keeping our employees? How are we keeping them happy? And tools like ours or HR tools are a key part of that too.
Well, listen, Andrew, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on, buddy. Love listening to it, and love the journey. But for anyone, I mean, I guess for anyone listening, whether they want HR software, whether they want to invest in the next round, you want to just give yourself a little shout out on where we can find you, how we can track you down?
Yeah, I mean, you can find me on LinkedIn, Andrew Swiler. It's on the video here, S-W-I-L-E-R. Or Twitter is usually the only other place that I show up on. My Twitter handle is SwilerA, so S-W-I-L-E-R-A. And then I have my own personal website, Swiler.me is mine. But other than that, I don't do Instagram. I don't have a SoundCloud. Don't have much Facebook presence. So you got to find me on one of those too.
Well, we'll put all that stuff on the show notes anyway, so people are cool. able to dig you up, buddy. But listen, thanks again, mate. Been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to hopefully doing a round two with you at some point in the future, and we can hear how the next part of the journey goes.
Yeah, hopefully without a cold next time.
It's been going around even virtually.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Matt.
All right, thanks, Andrew.